So does anyone still do word searches, or is that something that tends to disappear once you get to a certain age? What I love about word searches is the way to make them more difficult isn't adding a really long word. Those are easier to find. It also isn't going to really short words. You could accidentally have multiple correct answers in there, just not even meaning to. The way you make word searches difficult is by changing directionality. A word is written from left to right. Man, that's how I was taught how to read. That's easy. Diagonal? That's just left to right, but fancy. I got this. Backwards? Now we're starting to get somewhere. Backwards and diagonal. I mean, you might as well have it in a different language at that point. So I have a word search for us, and we can look at this this whole time, and I did discover something. It's a really fun way to get you to not listen to me. Put up a word search up there, because you're just like, what word am I supposed to... But you could be looking and have no idea what it is you're supposed to be looking for. I haven't told you what to find. I could tell you, hidden up there is the team name of the recent Stanley Cup champions, and you could look and still maybe miss it. I could tell you it's backwards and diagonal, and some of us still wouldn't find it. It's not until the answer is pointed out to us that it starts to emerge. It was right there the whole time, but it just wasn't what we were expecting, so we didn't see it. Or it's like pictures where there's an animal there, but it's an animal really adept at camouflage. We can look and look, and I know you're really far away from this picture, so I've taken something difficult and made it nearly impossible. We can look at this picture, it just looks like a cliff, and miss what's happening there. I can tell you there is a leopard in this picture, and we still wouldn't be able to see it until we're told, even when it's circled for us. Maybe we even zoom in a little bit. Maybe we still don't even see it, but it slowly emerges in there that there's a face that starts to be looking back at us. If and when we do see it, afterwards we can look at that very same picture again and see nothing else but it. The animal emerges, we see it, and there's nothing else we can see other than that. Let's try one more. We got this picture of this rocky cliff. Do you see it here? No, it's a picture of a rocky cliff. I want to know, do you see that picture? Yeah, there's nothing else in that picture. Maybe not so much that last one, but the word search and the leopard kind of makes me think about something. Sometimes when we're expecting to see something in a certain way, or sometimes we expect to see something in a certain way, and when that doesn't happen, well, we feel lost. We feel confused. What are we supposed to do? Maybe sometimes we're expecting to see something and there isn't actually anything there, like that rocky cliff. Maybe other times we're told something is there, or we're looking for it, and we can look and look, but it doesn't show up in the way that we expected it to. Like those darn backwards, diagonal word searches. It doesn't show up as we expect it to. We talked a lot at the beginning of our series in the book of Luke of how much expectation there was at the time of Jesus. For Israelites, it's been 400 years since they heard from God. 400 years between the end of the Old Testament and the start of the New Testament. And throughout that time, they've been conquered, then freed, then conquered, then freed, and then conquered again. They're currently under Roman rule, unable to live as they think God has called them to live, unable to worship as they think God has called them to worship. So you get this sense of desperation as they read through that Old Testament and they hear what God used to do, how he used to lead his people, how he used to guide them, how he used to give them grace and mercy, the means to cover their sins. Don't you hear like a sense of desperation, a sense of longing, of expectation? When will one come who can be a king like David, one to lead the people? God, you said a king would come. Where is he? When will one come who's a prophet, who can speak God's words to guide the people, one who surpasses even Moses? God, you said he would come. Where is he? When will one come who could be a priest like Aaron, who can help guide the people and lead them away from their sins to atone for sins? Where is he? Then we get to the ministry of Jesus, and this question keeps coming up explicitly or implicitly. Is he the one? Is he the one that we're waiting for? The one we've been expecting? But, and I'm sure it's frustrating, Jesus keeps refusing to answer that question. When he does a miracle, he says, don't tell anyone what you saw today. He keeps telling people to be silent and not tell anyone of what he is doing. All the more leading to this question, is he the one? And Jesus has been going towards Jerusalem. Ever since chapter 9, it says he set his face to go to Jerusalem, the holy city. And we've had 10 chapters now of Jesus is heading towards Jerusalem. He's going to Jerusalem. He's going to Jerusalem. It's building this expectation. Is something going to happen? Is he going to reveal who he is? And we get to our passage today where Jesus goes into Jerusalem. And we see that he is that expected one. Only he comes in a rather unexpected way. Like a word we're looking for, but it's backwards diagonal. Like a leopard that we just can't seem to see. It's there in plain sight, but it's not what we're expecting. Essentially what we could say about our passage today is unexpectedly, Jesus comes as the expected king, prophet, and priest. Israel has been waiting. When will a king come? When will a prophet come? When will a priest come? And Jesus is that expected one, but he comes in an unexpected way. So let's take that first title first. Jesus comes as the expected king. And we see this in the passage that Shelley read for us earlier, that of the triumphal entry, one that we normally read at Palm Sunday, which shows Jesus entering into the last week of his life, entering into Jerusalem. Rather than rereading it, let me just make a couple comments. I find it interesting that the bulk of his entry actually takes place before he enters in. We have this account of him sending the disciples to go and get this colt, this young animal that Matthew more specifically tells us is a young donkey. And there's a lot of questions as to what's going on here. Does Jesus prove that he has foreknowledge, that he's able to see what will happen, what is in the future? And so that's why he sends them. There's a colt there. They'll let you take it. Just you can go and do that. Or is this like some sort of pre-arranged thing where Jesus set it up in advance and the Lord has need of it is almost like a passphrase that shows that it's going back to Jesus? Honestly, we don't really know. I think it's more of the first one, but I think it's less important of how Jesus gets the colt than the fact that he gets on it. And we see the significance come out as we read through it. Let me reread verse 35 for us. So, and they, this is the disciples, brought it, the colt, to Jesus. And throwing their cloaks on the colt, they set Jesus on it. And as he rode along, they spread their cloaks on the road. I don't have it up there, but I'm going to read verse 37 as well. And as he was drawing near to Jerusalem, already on the way down the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of his disciples began to rejoice and praise God with a loud voice for the mighty works that they had seen. So this is a really intentional, deliberate, symbolic act. You don't often react this way when someone is sitting on a donkey, but all of Jesus' disciples are doing so many incredible things, laying cloaks on the road. They're singing songs. They're praising things. They're walking down the Mount of Olives. All of these are deliberate, symbolic pieces that are showing us that something significant is happening here, let alone the fact that Jesus is on the colt. You see, normally when people were going into Jerusalem at feast times or for festivals, they would walk into the city. Even if they rode an animal all the way to get to Jerusalem, which they travel from all over to do so, they might ride an animal for convenience, they would get off and walk that last little bit into the city. This was almost like to show their seriousness, a little bit of like religious type work. Then you have Jesus, who walks everywhere. Every single account of him that we have of him traveling is walking, except when he goes into the city. Him doing this reversal of what's expected, shows us that something significant is happening. This wasn't just he got tired for the last stretch of it. No, he's doing something deliberate. More than that, you have his disciples singing, and the song that they're singing comes from Psalm 118, which was normally sang when a king was enthroned or coronated. So clearly they're announcing that this man is coming as a king. And then they look around and they see they're on the Mount of Olives. See, the disciples would have had Zechariah 14 in their minds. Now, I will tell you this. I did not have Zechariah 14 in my mind when I was reading this passage. And maybe you're with me, that's not what you're thinking through as you hear this. But remember what we said about the Israelites. Their expectation is so heightened. They are waiting for this king to come. They would have been reminded of all the promises God made of what he would do. They would have been reminding themselves about that, hoping that every time that they feel the oppression under Rome, they would have been thinking about passages like this. This is Zechariah 14, verses 3-5. This is a prophecy of what will happen. It says, "Then the Lord will go out and fight against those nations," those who oppose God's people, "will fight against those nations as when he fights on the day of battle. And on that day, his feet shall stand," where? That was a lot of murmuring. Where do they stand? The Mount of Olives. Interesting. "Stand on the Mount of Olives that lies before Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives shall be split in two from east to west in a very wide valley, by a very wide valley, so that the one half of the mount shall move northward and the other half southward." There's a lot of symbolism there. Just the important part is the Mount of Olives, and then verse 5. "And you shall flee to the valley of my mountains, and the valley of the people shall reach to Azal. And you shall flee as you fled from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah." Here we go. "Then the Lord my God will come, and all the holy ones with him." So we have this passage here that talks about this individual on the Mount of Olives coming, and with it will come the Lord who will fight for God's people against the enemies. So Jesus' disciples, they look around. We are on Mount Olives. We're singing songs about this guy being king. We are treating him like a king. Oh, it's go time. Like, God is going to come and he is going to conquer our enemies. Clearly, all of this is happening for a reason. God is going to come and he's going to kick out Rome. You might have been the most powerful empire in the world has ever seen, but your days are numbered. That's what the disciples would have been thinking. But things go a little bit wrong. Or we should say, things go a little bit unexpectedly. For one, they can't even enter into the city before we see a response. This is Luke 14, verse 39. It says, "And some of the Pharisees," the religious leaders, "some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to him, 'Teacher, rebuke your disciples. Get them to stop.'" The disciples see this as an incredibly significant, symbolic moment. Jesus has come as that king. He's going to kick out the Romans. And the Pharisees say, no, you got to make them be quiet. They can't be doing this. And I think I can understand a little bit of their concern. It is dangerous to call someone a king if they're not a king. It is blasphemous to treat someone as the Messiah if they're not the Messiah. And clearly, the Pharisees didn't think Jesus was the Messiah, the one that was promised about in Zechariah 14 and elsewhere. He's not the one that we're expecting. And for them to not recognize Jesus is the Messiah, well, that clearly must be right, because who is the one leading this charge? Well, it says it's Jesus' disciples. We often think of the 12 disciples that he had, Peter, John. We tend to think of those 12 disciples, but it says the whole multitude of his disciples, all of those who are following Jesus. This would include former blind men who were probably still wearing their ratty beggar clothes. This would include women who Jesus showed love and care to at a time when they had very little rights and were not allowed to be part of a coronation. And so the Pharisees think, if we're not able to see Jesus as the Messiah, well, why would this ragtag bunch of people be able to? They don't see him as actually being that one. let alone the fact that Jesus is entering into the city in what we call a triumphal entry. But triumphal entries at the time didn't happen before battle. You don't often triumph before you've triumphed. It normally happens after fighting occurred. And so they'd ride in on a war horse with all the spoils of wars, with captives. And Jesus is here doing a lot of what they were expecting him to do. He's riding into the city, check. Coming from the Mount of Olives, check. He's being coronated by a crowd, check. But where is his army? When has he conquered before this? No, instead the Pharisees just look at him and see a man riding a donkey with a bunch of smelly northerners singing songs about him. But here's what we get to the purpose of what's happening. Jesus is coming unexpectedly, and yet he still is that expected king. By him focusing on a few of the symbols, embracing part of what was supposed to be done for a king, he is showing he is the one who was promised. But by him stripping away some of the other pieces, he's helping us to get to why he's actually entering into the city. He is showing us that he has not come for battle or for triumphing over Rome. He's actually come for something more important, more significant, something that was also prophesied back in the book of Zechariah. The crowd was expecting Zechariah 14, but instead he shows up with Zechariah 9:9. It says this: "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout aloud, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you, righteous and having salvation is he, humble and mounted on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey." To this point, Jesus has been so guarded about his identity, about who he is. And now he has this public display. He is embracing some of the symbols of what it means to be a king. He is announcing in one regard, I am that expected king. And yet he's coming to do something more significant than what the crowd thought he must do. Oh, clearly he's come to fight Rome. No, he has not come to conquer, but to unite people. Oh, clearly he's come for battle. No, he's not come with the sword, but with salvation. He is that expected king, but he's deliberately entering in a way that is showing that he is coming in an unexpected way. Because you do see him embrace that kingliness. The Pharisees say, rebuke your disciples, make them be quiet. And Jesus says, make them be quiet? I mean, you could try, but then the stones will sing out instead. Them stopping singing doesn't stop me from being king. Jesus is that expected king, but he comes in an unexpected way. And there's significant in this passage for us. The long-awaited king is entering into Jerusalem. The one who is waited for, the rightful ruler of the world. And by him entering into this way, not settling for temporary battles, Israel being rescued for a moment, but him coming in this lasting way with salvation as his goal, he shows that as king, his reign is supreme. He shows that he is that king who is awaited for, who is bringing a rule that is lasting, that is for all, a rule that is based in salvation rather than battles, a rule that is based in the uniting of people rather than the kicking out and conquering of others. There will be a day when Zechariah 14 comes, but here we have humility. Here we have peace. Here we have Jesus as the long-awaited ruler. And what we see for us is that as a king, he is due all that a king is due. Allegiance, obedience. And as the king whose rule is supreme, we give him all we are, all we have. This isn't because he's needy. This isn't because he needs this from us. The rocks can take over if we fail. But instead, what we see in Jesus entering in this way, bringing salvation, is that he is the ruler that we need. He is the rightful king over all who brings guidance and direction and peace and salvation in his ruling. He has come to right all wrongs, not with battle, not with war, but instead he comes with the cross. He enters into the city to bring salvation. And instead of triumphing through battle, he triumphs to the cross. And that is unexpected. Jesus is that expected king, but he comes in an unexpected way. He demonstrates that with how he enters. He demonstrates that with his obedience even to the cross. Second title that we have in our passage, unexpectedly, Jesus comes as the expected prophet. And we see this in the next section. This is Luke 19, starting in verse 41. It says, and when he drew near, this is Jesus, when he drew near and saw the city, he wept over it, saying, would that you, even you, had known on this day the things that make for peace. And now they are hidden from your eyes. For the days will come upon you when your enemies will set up a barricade around you and surround you and hem you in on every side and tear you down to the ground, you and your children within you. And they will not leave one stone upon another in you because you did not know the time of your visitation. We said that Israel was waiting for the day when someone would come as a prophet who would speak God's words to come and to guide the people to say what it is that God was saying to all of them. So Jesus shows up and he starts to speak like a prophet does. You all have turned away from God and there's eagerness here. Yes, yes, tell us, how do we get back? What are the good things God has in store for us? How is he going to rescue us? How is he going to show us grace and mercy? And Jesus finishes the sentence by saying, you will be destroyed. That's unexpected. And for us, reading this passage is unexpected as well. We just said Jesus entered into the city not as a militant ruler, but instead he enters with a sign of peace and humility. He goes from Jesus has not come to bring war, but peace, to now because, as the prophet, because you haven't accepted peace, you will lose a war. And both of these go together, I think. Because Israel rejected their peaceful, rightful king, which we already saw in the last passage, the Pharisees started to do that, rebuke your disciples from saying what's true. Because they reject their rightful, peaceful king, there will be a day when they're destroyed. And what's fascinating to me, Deuteronomy 18, we don't need to turn there. You can read it later so you're not just trusting that I'm making this up. Deuteronomy 18 is the passage that says, there will one day come a prophet who surpasses even Moses. And Moses was one of the most important people to Israel who guided and led and God spoke through in such incredible ways that have never been seen again since. And one who will come who's a prophet greater than Moses. Deuteronomy 18 also tells us the sign by which we can know if a prophet is a true prophet or not, which is, does what they say come to pass? If I'm up here saying, oh, I'm a prophet, I'm making up all these things and none of them happen, you would start to question my prophethood? Profitability, we'll say that one. You would question that about me. So does what a prophet says come to pass? That is the sign of whether or not they're a true prophet. Jesus says that Jerusalem will be destroyed. Soon after Jesus dies, that's exactly what happened. And to this day, in the temple, all save one wall has not even been rebuilt to this day. Stones were taken off, stripped, burned to the ground, ravaged. To this day, the temple itself, all but one wall has yet to be rebuilt. Now, before we think, oh, how cool is it that he was able to see this all the way back when he was on earth, he could see such a thing happen. No, this should cause us to weep. That's how Jesus responds to this. He weeps. The stakes that Jesus are talked about is more than just stones being built on top of other stones. These are eternal stakes. And for rejecting his words that he proves to be true, rejecting him as a prophet, well, it leads to a similar destruction for all people. And so there's significance in this passage for us, that Jesus comes as that expected prophet who speaks the very words of God, who what he says comes to be true. As a prophet, his words are sure. And so we trust in what he says. We obey what he says, not just to avoid the negative repercussions. Destruction sounds bad. I don't want that, so I'll trust in Jesus. No, there's so much good in this life that's mentioned even just here. He says, it's an incredibly beautiful but haunting phrase, "Would that you, even you, had known the things that make for peace." Peace is available to you. And that same peace that's offered is offered to us as well. This isn't just a lack of fighting, but any disquiet within us, feeling on shaky ground. We're saying that he is a firm foundation because he comes bringing peace. That is on offer to us. The time of the visitation, the Lord has come to them. They didn't realize that. That means the Lord has come. That truth is real for us. God has come to be with his people. His teaching here is that life is available with God and the peace that comes from that. And so we turn to him, we trust in him, because in his words we find a way to live. We find life and joy and peace and his presence. He is that expected prophet. But like a backwards diagonal word on a word search, it wasn't noticed. It was missed. People weren't expecting it to come in that way. But he is that expected prophet. Third title that we have, unexpectedly, Jesus comes as the expected priest. Let me read Luke 19, starting in verse 45. It says, "And he entered the temple and began to drive out those who sold, saying to them, 'It is written, my house shall be a house of prayer, and you have made it a den of robbers.' And he was teaching daily in the temple, and the chief priests and the scribes and the principal men of the people were seeking to destroy him, but they did not find anything they could do, for all the people were hanging on his words." So the temple was the center point of religious activity for the Israelites. It served a variety of functions, but none more important than the sacrificial system. See, God is perfect and holy and good. And any deviation from any person, from the standard that he sets for us, is sin. And that sin needs to be atoned for. See, until that, we cannot draw near to him. We can't even properly worship him. We can't be in any sort of relationship with the God of the universe, which is we were designed to be in relationship with the God of the universe. And so this sin needed to be accounted for, needed to be atoned for. It needed to be covered. And so God introduced a way to show the seriousness of sin, the significance of sin, that by having an animal sacrificed, that could be a covering, an atonement for sin at the time. Now, I want you to imagine this. You live far outside of Jerusalem, and you are traveling into the city to sacrifice an animal on behalf of you and your family. That's a long walk that you got to go. And so you need to bring provisions for you and your family to make the journey. You need to bring things to stay comfortably. If you're having to stay outside the city, you might need something to sleep on, perhaps. You'll need to bring things to protect yourself. The roads were really treacherous. People would come because they saw people are bringing money into the city. What if we just take that money from them? And so thieves and robbers are all around. You need to protect yourself. To add animal and things to care for an animal to your packing list, well, that's going to make that journey even more difficult. And so an enterprising mind at the temple thought, well, why don't we just sell animals and grain here? So rather than people having to cart their animal all the way out here, rather than them trying to take care of it because if it gets a blemish on it, then you can't sacrifice it, rather than them having to do all that work, what if we just sell it here? Wouldn't that be so much easier? Wouldn't that be a kindness to do? And then someone else thought, well, if they're relying on buying an animal here, they walk all this way, the sole purpose of them coming is to sacrifice an animal, can't I pretty much charge them whatever I want? I mean, what are they going to do? Walk all the way back home, get an animal, walk all the way back out here with it? And so they turned getting in good standing with God into a thriving business. And Jesus comes in and he kicks out all those who sold, kicks them out of the temple, removes them. He says, you have turned this into a den of robbers. They've taken becoming in good standing with God into a business. And the response of that is that we see the chief priests and the scribes and the principal men, the leaders of that area are seeking to destroy Jesus. This is no longer, you know, we don't like some of the things Jesus is doing, or Jesus and I don't see eye to eye on things. No, they want to destroy him. Why? Well, he got rid of their revenue stream. And what we see is that Jesus kicks them out, and I think we get a little bit more symbolism. He removes those who are selling things. He gets rid of those who sell animal and grain, and what does he replace them with? Himself. The very next verse kicks out those selling. Next verse, and he was teaching in the temple. He removes those who were selling animals and the things for sacrifices, and he replaces it with himself in the temple. Jesus is the expected priest, one who would come and help people get in good standing with God. But rather than being part of the existing system, rather than offering sacrifices and grain offerings himself, he instead replaces that with himself. See, Jesus is that expected priest, and as priest, his sacrifice is sufficient. He doesn't just rely on what was there before. He comes in an unexpected way. He comes in a new way. He offers a sacrifice instead that doesn't need to be repeated. It doesn't need to be paid for. You don't need to exchange money for it. You don't need to come to some place and offer it year after year. You don't need to offer a new sacrifice every time that we fall short of God's perfect standard. He instead offers a sacrifice that's sufficient by going to the cross. This is so utterly fascinating. In these three accounts, we see why Jesus goes to the cross. In a simple way, Jesus comes entering the city as a king in a very public announcement. And that's why the cross happens. Jesus comes as a prophet saying that Jerusalem will be destroyed, and that's why the cross happens. Jesus comes into the temple and disrupts the practices that were happening. That's why the cross happens. See, if Jesus would have entered the city like a good little pilgrim boy and just behaved himself, if he would have just kept his mouth shut about Jerusalem, if he just would have offered sacrifices, which everyone else was able to do without problem, he could have left after this week without an issue, had a long, successful career. But instead, we see the true reason. Why did the cross happen? Because that is the means by which God is bringing restoration to people. That is the means by which God is bringing life and peace as this king, this prophet, this priest comes and dies on our behalf. Now that is unexpected. Unexpectedly, Jesus comes as the expected king, priest, and prophet. And as we read these accounts, we see that he surpasses even the greatest of expectations at the time. See, as king, his reign is supreme. He's not just ruling over one city, one nation, but instead he is ruler of the universe. And in response to that, we turn to him, we obey him, we look to him for all guidance in life. As prophet, his words are sure. He doesn't just say some things, but you need to be around him or receive a letter from him. No, his words ring true through all generations. And all generations turn to him for guidance, for direction in life. As priest, his sacrifice is sufficient. He doesn't just offer a necessarily repeatable sacrifice every year or daily. Whenever we mess up, he offers a once and for all sacrifice of himself. And see, these truths that we see here, this surpassing all expectations at the time, this isn't just something that we can be passive about. This requires a response, a king entering into our presence. We can't just go about our day as usual. A prophet speaking the very words of God, we can't just say, oh, that's nice. A priest offering such a sacrifice as this, we can't just continue living as if nothing has happened. And we see this in light of the poor responses in each one of these sections that we read. The Pharisees try to get Jesus to rebuke his disciples. Jerusalem misses that the Lord has visited them. The chief priests, scribes, and leading men seek to destroy Jesus. All of them miss what's going on. All of them respond in just the absolutely wrong way. It's when we compare this to last week, when we think of the blind man who is unable to see Jesus and yet responds well to him, when we think of Zacchaeus who's unable to see Jesus because of the crowd and yet responds to him, what is it that the blind men see that others do not? See, I bring this up and I've been hitting the significance for us because my worry is that we, maybe in this room or we as people, might be at risk of doing the same thing. We're all looking. Like the Pharisees were expecting this king, the priest, the prophet to come. They were looking for him. The chief priest would have done the same. All of Israel would have done the same. We're all looking. We're looking for direction in life. What are we supposed to do? How do we live? But we might miss that the king has come, offering guidance and life that's for our good and for his glory. We're all looking for something that brings peace, that makes us feel at ease, that quiets some of the disquiet that is within us. And we're all looking to things in this world that might give us a little bit of that, a little bit of hope. And yet all things in this world come to an end. And whatever we think that might give us a little bit of peace, well, it has an expiration date on it. All of us are looking for some sort of satisfaction. We're looking for something permanent. We're looking for something that gives us meaning, significance. We're all on a quest for significance. And yet what we see is that we continue to not be able to create that for ourselves. Israel was looking for this, and yet they missed it. They missed their king. They missed their prophet. They missed their priest. Jesus said to them, would that you, even you, know the things that make for peace, but they were hidden from their eyes. But in this being recorded, in Jesus in such a public way, announcing that the king has come, the prophet has come, the priest has arrived, we see that these things don't have to be hidden from us who are looking for these things. So behold your king. Behold your prophet, behold your priest, behold your God, behold your Jesus. He has come. Unexpectedly, yes, but he has come, bringing all that we are all looking for. Let me pray for us. Father, we are so grateful that you have been building to this moment of you entering into the city of